Sheikh Javid, a very quick question that might be really, desirable at the beginning of this episode is that, you know, in some countries, especially where there are deserts and people live in the deserts like Bedouins, and they might access different kinds of animals such as rabbits or hares, or even in Australia, for example, in the deserts of Australia, you may find kangaroos. Are they basically ritually edible or halal?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I would like to say that some Muslims, not Shia Muslims, but of course Sunni Muslims, eat rabbit meat, and of course according to their school of jurisprudence, rabbit is halal. But according to the school of Ahlul Bayt and the Shia school, of course rabbit is haram and there is no doubt about it. As for kangaroos are concerned, of course kangaroos are also haram, and the Shia scholars are all unanimous about the kangaroos being haram.
Mm-hmm.
So we should understand that especially the Shia Muslims living in a predominantly Sunni community,
yes,
they should understand that there are some
differences.
Yeah, when it comes to halal and haram things that we consume on a daily basis, there are some things which are halal according to Sunni Islam or according to Hanafi or Shafi'i, Hanbali, Maliki schools, but those things are haram according to us. For example, rabbit is it's commonplace among Sunnis. It's halal, okay, but for us it is haram and we cannot consume it. Even if it's the hair of a rabbit, if it is on your clothes or on your body and you know that it is, you cannot pray with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is basically haram for the Shias to consume rabbit meat and also kangaroos.
Oh, right. What about use of properties of a non-Muslim person? Can we basically make use of the properties that belong to a non-Muslim? And if he or she is a Muslim but doesn't pay the khums, the one-fifth, like type of charity where you have to actually pay like one-fifth of your capital,
yes,
if it stays somewhere for more than 1 year, can we make use of the property of a person, even of a Muslim? I'm talking about a Muslim, but doesn't really pay homes.
Well, as for, because you asked me two questions. The first one, can we, for example, use the property of a non-Muslim? I think we cannot use non-Muslim's property. Their property is inviolable in the sense that we cannot use their property without their consent, without their permission, unless authorized,
yes,
by them. We cannot use their property illicitly and unlawfully.
No, that was not the case. Basically, I asked the question like when they authorize, when they give us something.
That's something else, of
yes,
course. Of course, if they offer you food to eat, okay, like even if you are living in a country like India with majority Hindu population,
mm-hmm,
or with Sikh population, there are let's say 1 billion Hindus living in India, more than 1 billion,
mm-hmm,
and these are people you live with on a daily basis, you interact with them.
Yes,
if they offer you food and you don't know at all, you don't know that the food is impure or it contains haram ingredients, as long as the food does not contain meat,
mm-hmm,
you can eat it. You can eat, for example, biscuits, cookies, and food mm-hmm products,
yes,
which are produced in the same country without having to investigate whether the food or the product is pure or impure. You can treat them as pure.
Yes.
This is the answer to the first question. As for
the
second question is concerned, the thing that is given to you to consume, to eat, and you know that the khums of that item has not been paid, or maybe you have doubt about it. Of course, according to Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, you can eat that food, and it's not your responsibility to give khums of that property or that thing. For example, to make it a bit clear, breadwinner of a family, the father, for example, goes out working, he saves his money, and he does not pay khums.
Mm-hmm.
He's not in the habit of paying khums. And at the end of the year, he gifts some money to his children. Now, some of the children want to know whether it's their responsibility to check whether the khums of khums has been paid from that amount or not, or they don't have to check. Of course, according to Supreme Leader, it's not their responsibility to check whether khums has been paid from that amount, from that gift or not. It is absolutely halal for the children, for the wife,
mm-hmm.
for the dependents to take that money and to use it for any purpose they
without
want.
Investigation.
Without investigation. Even if they know for sure that that khums has not been paid from that money, even then it's permissible for them to use that money, and it's not necessary.
Aren't they obliged actually to pay the khums after they made certain?
Yeah, even if they made, it's not because they are dependents. They are not the people who earn money,
mm-hmm.
who actually save the money. Of course, it's not their responsibility to pay khums from that amount, and it of course the father, who is actually the guardian of the family and who is the breadwinner, it is his responsibility to purify his property, to give khums from whatever he has saved and over which 1 year has passed. Okay.
Yes.
If he does not pay, he will remain indebted. He will remain liable for the khums amount.
Right. But does the same rule apply to zakat, another type of charity which is prevalent in Islam?
Zakat, as you know, zakat is not payable on your savings.
Mm-hmm.
For example, you have $1 million
mm-hmm.
Saved in your bank account. Zakat is not payable on it. Zakat is payable on specific items like wheat, like barley, like dates, like raisins, like sheep, camels, cows, and these are the things.
And some agricultural products.
Of course.
Right?
Wheat, barley, as I said.
Yes.
So, people living in the city, they are not supposed to give homes. They are not supposed to give zakat.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it is the farmers. It is the those people who keep cattles in the villages, in the rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
They are the ones who have to understand the rules of zakat. They are, some of them, not all of them, because zakat has its taxable limit.
Right.
For example, if you have 40 camels, you have to give one as zakat.
Mm-hmm.
And if unless the things that you have reach the taxable limit, you are not supposed to give zakat.
I see.
So people who live in the cities, some of the people might want to know whether zakat is payable on gold or not.
Yes.
Zakat is not payable on gold even at this time, because gold is no longer used for bartering, for buying things. Nowadays, people use paper currency. They use coins,
mm-hmm.
which are not made of gold.
Yes.
And they are no longer using gold as a means for purchasing things, okay?
Yes.
So therefore, zakat is not payable on gold coins also.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, there are specific items on which zakat is payable.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ocean of Dua.
Inni as'aluka al-huda wat-tuqa wal-'afafa wal-ghina.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear listeners, brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Rarsi, and we're gonna be with you with another edition of The Ocean of Dua. In this version of the program, inshallah, we will discuss the true meaning of prayer and dua, the value of prayer, ways of reaching the Almighty Allah, acceptance and also benefits of dua. So stay with us. Talking about two important principles, the principles regarding the intimacy and hub that is within our hearts. In the previous program, we concluded that these two principles do not contradict. In fact, it is true that heart gives out what it takes in, but it is also true that the heart is a conscious receptacle and it comprehends what is delivered to it and it can distinguish the truth from the falsehood. prior to that, you may remember that we were talking about the beautiful whispered prayer of Muridin, the words of Imam Zain al-Abidin alayhi salam. You may remember that Imam Zain al-Abidin calls on Allah with this touching call and says, "Oh, he who comes toward those who come toward him, and grants gifts and bestows bounty upon them through tenderness, and who is compassionate and clement toward those heedless of his remembrance, and loving and tender in drawing them to his door."
رَبَّنَا آتِنَا فِي الدُّنْيَا حَسَنَةً وَفِي الْآخِرَةِ حَسَنَةً وَقِنَا عَذَابَ النَّارِ وَقِنَا عَذَابَ النَّارِ.
These beautiful words, and actually this call, entails two points. The first point is that Allah the Exalted comes towards those who come toward Him and reverts to them by His grace. And the second point is that He is clement towards those who are heedless of Him and repels heedlessness from them through lordly attractions. After this preamble, Imam Zain al-Abidin alayhi salam invokes Allah to make him among the righteous ones with the biggest share of His mercy, the highest status, and the greatest lot of His love. He says, "I ask you to make me amidst them one with the fullest share from you, the highest station with you, the most plentiful portion of your love, and the most excellent allotment of your knowledge." This phrase, dear listeners, gives rise to this question. Why is it that Imam just a while ago was wishing that he would be joining those righteous ones, and now he is longing from Allah that He may make him to be the one with the fullest share and highest station with them? How can these requests be put beside each other? What had transpired in the atmosphere of the prayer, as well as the soul of the Imam alayhi salam, during this supplication? Why did he make this request? And how did Imam alayhi salam move from the request of joining the righteous to the desire to attain precedence over them and to lead them? The importance of the question is more clear if we have a look and ponder over the previously mentioned principles, the principles of qalb, specifically the second one, that the heart is able to choose between the right and the wrong. The answer to this question, however, requires an explanation of a secret from among the secrets of the prayers. The secret is that Allah the Exalted has taught us not to slacken off in asking, and not to desist from praying, so long as the master is generous, and how vile it is to desist from praying when the one asked from is the generous, and there is no limit or end to the treasuries of his mercy. On the contrary, the frequency of giving increases him not, but in generosity and kindness.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. تشنگی آور به دست. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. تا بجوشد آب از بالا و دست. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God and the mercy will. God will come towards you.
Paradise, thank you Allah. Now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through. Knowing that God stays with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true. And we know we'll be here forever.
The ocean of dua.
In this regard, a few programs ago, I assume we talked about the story of an old woman, the one who the Prophet ﷺ talked about when he wanted to teach us to have lofty requests from the Almighty Allah. And from among the things that Allah the Exalted has taught us of the manners and characters of the servants of the All-Merciful is that we should ask from Him to make us the leaders of the pious ones. As the Holy Quran says, وَجْعَلْنَا لِلْمُتَّقِينَ إِمَامًا, and make us the leaders of the God-weary. And not only that, we frequently come across these high aspiring phrases in the supplications that have reached us from our infallibles. They say, and give preference to me, and do not give preference to anyone else over me. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program as well. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Inside Israel.
Subhuman conditions in Israel for foreign workers and migrants. That's according to a report by Israel's Hotline for Refugees and Migrants NGO. It describes treatment by Israeli authorities of detained migrants akin to torture. Migrants, according to the NGO, are being hit with belts, have lack of contact with the outside world, and receive just moments of free time in the open air in Israel.
14 months you've been in the detention facility in the south of Israel. And 14 months, you make connections, like you said. You are living all day for 14 months with people. And one day, they are seeing you getting out of there. How do they feel about this?
I mean, it is really very sad that being incarcerated there for 14 months. There are a lot of people also for more than that. And there is no any justification at all. They release me without... telling me why, and I'm sure that they gain nothing of incarcerating somebody like me or others who are in Holot right now. There is no gain out of it at all other than torturing some other human beings.
In one location alone, there are 11,465 detainees, including 370 children and 4,969 women. They are living in subhuman conditions that fail to meet legal standards. A new report by an Israeli human rights group paints a picture of humiliating treatment towards foreign workers and migrants. It shows the extent of unlawful arrest and actual physical violence that they face. The report by the Hotline for Refugees and Migrants for 2019 gathered dozens of testimonies. It revealed shocking incidents at several migrant detention facilities where migrants are detained. The report states that dozens of detainees were imprisoned for months in several detention facilities all across Israel. In fact, according to the report, authorities in these facilities used extreme methods to control the detainees. These methods include beatings with a belt and the forced use of sleeping pills. One such facility is the Yahalom Detention Center. It is located at Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv, the capital. In 2019, it held approximately 11,465 detainees, including 370 children and 4,969 women in subhuman conditions that failed to meet legal standards. Many of the tortured migrants come from Africa and Southeast Asia. Israel's Ynet News cites care worker from the Philippines who worked in Israel for 15 years as saying, "The three of us were locked in a small room without a TV and without our phones that were confiscated." The report also found that immigration inspectors are now breaking into places of residence by force. Additionally, the report claims that in 2019, there was a sharp increase in the number of deported families. It claims that the actual total number of deportees amounted to 6,694. The data and evidence reveal conduct that violates the High Court's directive and even the immigration authorities' own procedures, according to Sigal Rosen from the Hotline for Refugees and Migrants.
Main trends we identified were detention of those who denied entry to Israel, preventing those who have been denied entry from applying for asylum when they wanted to. There was, again, cases of violence by immigration authority inspectors towards detainees. In the last year, there was a special problem of detention of families with children, school children, ahead of their deportation from Israel. During the last year, the immigration authority started focusing on efforts to detain school-aged children. This population was previously spared from detention and deportation, but in the last year, the immigration started arresting these children, especially in order to deport them. Unfortunately, the Israeli immigration policy is to allow the immigration of Jews only, and whoever is not Jewish and is not entering to Israel under the law of return, but under the entry to Israel law, the Israeli government is doing whatever in its power to arrest and deport him. Well, if Israel doesn't want non-Jews to live in this country, then they just don't need to bring these people. Right now, and actually anytime, there is more than 100,000 legal migrant workers that the government is initiating their entry into the country. It is not reasonable to invite all these people and then to deport them. And this is already amount to torture. Detaining a migrant who committed no crime just because Israel failed to deport him for such long years without any prospect for release is definitely a torture.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Trap Lab says COVID-19 made the situation of some of the most vulnerable workers worse and introduced some highly restrictive targeted policies that had grave impact on their lives. Hopefully, it also created an opportunity to rethink policies and reassess how to address vulnerabilities. Brin says Israel's crimes include ethnic cleansing, bouts of genocide in Gaza, torture of children, theft of land, targeted killings and murder, house demolitions, and myriads more since the squatter entity was unilaterally declared in Palestine by a Polish immigrant in May 1948.
The facts are that Israel signed the UN Convention on Refugees, which means that they're supposed to give refugees and according to international law, regardless of the convention, but they're supposed to give refugees safe haven if they're leaving from a country where they're in trouble, where they're in danger. And obviously that's not what's really happening on the ground. They face a lot of racism, they face a lot of legal and bureaucratic issues. So on the one hand, on paper, Israel is supposed to be treating them in a different way than what's happening on the ground. So of course, in any country, when an immigrant or an asylum seeker comes for work or to flee danger, they're obviously at a disadvantage, right? Because of language, because of legal issues, because of all kinds of things, and so it's easy to exploit them. Here, we have a particularly difficult situation because, as I explained, most of the asylum seekers are not getting legal and social help from the government. And so, you know, they need to somehow be able to raise their families, to feed their kids. So if they're, you know, working under the table or working at restaurants and being taken advantage of, the system is sort of set up to do that rather than to help.
Okay, so yes, in general, I think there's a fundamental racist problem in Israel. It has always been an issue in Israel. The targets of the racism have changed. It was at the beginning, I would say, the Arab population or the Sephardic population, what we call the people that came from north of Africa and Yemen. They suffer from systematic racism towards even from the beginning. And of course, now that we have the Ethiopian Jews that came to Israel 20, 30, 40 years ago, and of course, the asylum seekers coming from Africa, they all suffer from a systematic racist problem in Israel. It's quite unbelievable, even. It's heartbreaking, and you can see the results. Actually, the Ethiopian Jews. I was in a trial yesterday of Salomon Tuta, a young Jewish Ethiopian boy that was murdered by the police. That he was shot by a police officer. We have succeeded to raise awareness, and there's a trial going on, which is quite exceptional. But we know that the trial will not bring anything, and the policeman is not blamed of murdering the boy. He's blamed of, I don't know, some sort of something else. But in general, we have a long list of young Ethiopian boys that are being imprisoned, criminalized, killed. So of course, when it comes to even the Jewish black community, the asylum seekers suffer from it much more. I think basically it stems from the fact that the Jewish community that established, the Zionists that has established Israel, came from Western Europe countries, East European countries. I think they all suffer from racism until today. So basically, I think we brought the racism from Europe to Israel, when you think about the people that established Israel, including my great-grandparents and my family from both sides. So I think they came with the notion that anything that is not European is not equal to them. And of course, I think it had to do with the fact that we had to basically, we're committing ethnic cleansing towards the Arab population in that was here in Palestine. So in order to do that, you have to make them subhuman. And I think that, you know, echoes the way we treated the community, the Jewish community that came, as I said, from the northern part of Africa or from Yemen. They received the same treatment. They have been their culture, their language, everything that they brought with them was valued as less, as not as good as the coming things that came from east of Europe. So basically, I think it's something that's rooted in the Zionists and the Jewish society here in Israel.
The daunting report reveals a sharp increase in the number of immigrant families imprisoned for the purpose of deportation from Israel. And for the first time, it also aimed to detain students. Such torture of migrants is not new. In 2018, the United Nations said that migrants in Israel suffered from abuse and torture before they were ultimately deported. The UN refugee conducted research into the subject and highlighted 80 individual cases of people who risked their lives after they were relocated by Israel and then had to make hazardous journeys to Europe through Libya. The UN said that migrants suffered abuse, torture, and extortion before risking their lives once again by crossing the Mediterranean to Italy after Israel had sent them away. In April 2018, Israel reached an agreement with the United Nations to expel around 16,000 African migrants to Western countries in exchange for granting temporary residency in Israel to the same number. Shortly after, however, the deal was cancelled by the Israeli regime.
All these years, actually, since 2013, when Israel started sending asylum seekers to Rwanda and Uganda, only asylum seekers who decided to move to these countries left. No one was taken there by force. It is correct that many of them felt coerced to go there because of the heavy decrees and laws that locked them down in prison, in Cholot, all the economic decrees that took away such a large amount of their salaries and left them with no means to live. The international law brutally when it deals with both asylum seekers and migrant workers. We see in the case of migrant workers that people are detained in illegal condition, not just according to international law, but also according to the Israeli law. And regarding asylum seekers, we see that Israel do not bother to check the asylum claims, detain them, coerce them to move to other country, and limit their freedom of movement in a way that violates the Refugee Convention.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Suburb says that an Israeli court rules the city to be a white city and that schools for blacks or funding transport for black school children to attend school elsewhere are liable to alter the city's demographic balance. This could incentivize blacks to move into the city, damaging its white character. Fatima says that the crimes that are happening all over the world against the oppressed Yemenis, Palestinians, Afghans, Indians, Chinese, blacks, etc. are being planned by the United States and Israel. The international community must protest against these atrocities. Ali says the extinction of insects and reptiles is important to the United Nations.
And there are different types of immigrants in Israel. There are migrant workers and there are asylum seekers, as I said. But it's very, very difficult to naturalize in Israel if you're not coming and making aliyah, if you're not coming as a Jew from a different country and trying to live here permanently. It's nearly impossible to naturalize here, including if you're an immigrant, a non-Jewish immigrant that wants to marry or marries outside of the country, a citizen. So there's a lot of bureaucracy, and the legal system is not set up to help migrant workers and refugees, and this is why they're a vulnerable community in Israel. And so, you know, even things like getting social services during a global pandemic, as I said, the deposit law was canceled, but there are lots of other issues and social benefits that other people living here, citizens mainly, are receiving that these people are not receiving because they're not really recognized.
And I'm here in order to make a change. We have a prime minister who's divisive, who is splitting the country, who is ruining our economy, and who is undermining the structure of democracy.
I'm coming here to protest for 6 months because our Prime Minister has he's criminal, and he's kind of dictator, and we want him out.
Basically, Israel does not respect any international law. Neither it doesn't respect the international law, the asylum, the refugee convention, the Geneva Convention. Sorry, it has never been committed to anything in the Geneva Convention regarding asylum seekers, regarding refugees. But it also does the same thing towards the Palestinians. There are no international laws, none whatsoever, that Israel respects. Even the deportation, they found a system with these third countries. I call them the revolving door, Rwanda and Uganda, which they did not even allow to say their name in courts. By the way, I went to Uganda, and we also had connections with parliament members of Uganda. That's one of the reasons that his program has failed. We collected testimonies, and we know that Israel has done everything it's in its power to either walk around these international laws or bluntly, you know, bluntly go away, disregard them in general. I would even say that the Supreme Court of Israel itself does not respect the international law. It doesn't say so out front, but it definitely does everything in its power to override these international laws. Public pressure create a change? No. Public pressure, if it's not governments, cannot create a change, okay? The whole BDS movement, which basically Israel is very worried by it, cannot really create change because we're not talking about governments. We're talking about private people, NGOs, or whatever. If the only way, I think, basically, if you ask me, and this is what we have worked towards with 2018, when we were hoping that the deal with the UN would go through. Israel will never accept its small amount of asylum seekers. We're talking about less than 30,000 asylum seekers that are even not called asylum seekers. They're called infiltrators. They're called infiltrators by the Supreme Court. No, these people will never receive fair treatment. They will never be considered human beings, basically.
The migrants that have been tortured include workers that have been working in Israel for decades. They are cheap labor and working conditions that Israeli employees do not. They do not receive any incentives or benefits. In fact, many of them do not see their paychecks in years. Israel has been allowing this to go on for decades. To many of these migrants and laborers, they are being treated as modern-day slaves. Israel has promised them savings forcefully cut from their paychecks if they leave. Israel has been wanting them to leave for years. Now it is executing mass imprisonment of this minority group of people. It remains to be seen what actions the UN will take after the latest torture report in Israel. Here is the news making the press in Israel. The Jerusalem Post, the father of Facebook Israel CEO and an active protester against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, was killed after being struck by a car during an anti-Netanyahu protest at the entrance of the city of Sabion. Police ruled out any intention to harm by the driver, a woman in her 20s. The Times of Israel. Hackers published sensitive client information stolen from Sherbet Insurance after the company refused on Friday to pay the approximately $1 million ransom demanded. The group responsible for the attack, Black Shadow, had said that if the requested sum of now 200 bitcoins was transferred into its account, it would not publish or sell the information. I-24 News. Amir Peretz, Israel's economy minister and head of the Labor Party, announced that he will be running for Israel's presidency in 2021. Peretz, who was the military minister during the 2006 Second Lebanon War, made the announcement in an interview with Army Radio. Israel's current president, Reuven Rivlin, is set to step down in mid-2021, with the Knesset, Israeli parliament, tasked with electing the next president. Ynet News. Two Israeli teenagers have been arrested on suspicion of sexually abusing two small children over a period of 2 years, the police said. According to the police, some of the abuses of the children, aged 4 and 7, took place inside a local synagogue. During the covert probe, the investigators gathered findings and collected evidence from several children, which helped them to uncover the affair.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother, I'm Muhammad. And today, I'm going to read to you an aphorism of Imam Ali from Nahjul Balagha. Before that, let's go ahead and listen to the Arabic words, and after that, I'm going to read you the English translation. Stay with us.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام والله لدنياكم هذه أهون في عيني من عراق خنزير في يد مجزوم.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, By Allah, this world of yours is more lowly in my view than the leftover bone of a pig in the hand of a leper.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. Now, one of the amazing things which we learn from Imam Ali alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, is this idea that the Imams had ilm al-ghayb, this knowledge of the unseen. Now, what is interesting is that this knowledge of the unseen is not a knowledge which one can acquire via physical means. Rather, this is knowledge which is endowed upon certain people whom Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Almighty, exalted is Allah, whom Allah finds fit and capable and worthy of such knowledge. And so it is Allah who bestows this knowledge upon people. Now, one of the examples in which we find Imam Ali's knowledge about the unseen is regarding his words about Talha and Zubair. Now, when Talha and Zubair, when they went to Imam Ali to get permission to go on the minor Hajj, the Umrah, reacting to this interesting request from Talha and Zubair, Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him, says, By Allah, you two are not leaving here for performing the minor Hajj, the Umrah. In fact, you have not intended to do so. Your main destination is Basra. Now, keeping in mind that there is a very big and large distance between Mecca, where Talha and Zubair were saying that they were going, and Basra, which is in present-day Iraq. And then Imam Ali alayhi salam says, But let it be known to you that Allah will foil their plots and will return their tricks to themselves. I will soon gain victory over them. We find that later on in history, this is exactly what happened, as Imam Ali alayhi salam had foreseen, where Talha and Zubair did not go to Umrah to Mecca, but rather they went to Basra, and furthermore, that the plots of Talha and Zubair to attain the caliphate of the Muslims was foiled by Allah, and it was Imam Ali who gained victory over them in the battle of Jamal, the battle of the camel. And so here, dear brothers and sisters, we learn a profound lesson One, that there are people in this world who are endowed with a special and unique knowledge of the unseen. And two, it is therefore these people, such as the Holy Prophet and his 12 divinely appointed disciples, whom should be followed for the salvation of humanity. A beautiful lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, about the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib this means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridvi.
A leader does admonishment. And if they are sometimes angry with their followers, it doesn't mean he's condemning them. Basically, a sincere leader will always look for the betterment of his community. Whenever he sees weaknesses, he will talk about it. What is Amr bil Ma'ruf and Nahy al Munkar? Wherever he will find weakness in his own followers, he will talk to them. That, well, this is the problem with you, better, you know, change yourself. This is not only Ali, this is actually the sunnah of Rasulullah himself. And even the sunnah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Just two examples. Look at Surah Jumu'ah. The last ayat of Surah Jumu'ah is very interesting. Well, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَإِذَا رَأَوْا تِجَارَةً أَوْ لَحْوًا انْفَضُّوا إِلَيْهَا وَتَرَكُوكَ قَائِمًا. What does it mean? What is this ayah saying? We repeat it every Friday. It is actually a reminder. The Rasul is in Nabi, Masjid al-Nabi, in Medina. It is the time of Jummah khutbah. And who are there? Mushrikeen? No. They are all Muslimin, not only Muslimin, because they see Rasulullah all of them by definition are Sahaba. Now what happens one day? A trade caravan happened to come into the city